If you prefer manual, time-consuming processes, then this message isn't for you. But if you want to slash per loan cost and boost productivity, then exploring Indicom's Genius Suite is your next step. Integrate Genius into your operations or pair Genius with Indicom's expert mortgage services for proven ROI. Learn how to get Genius at work by visiting Indicom.com.
Welcome back, Housing News listeners. This is Alcina Lloyd, and I'm the producer of this weekly podcast, which is a proud member of the Industry Syndicate. Today, you'll be listening to the premiere of Season 4, which comes with a surprise. While we will miss HW Media's founder and CEO, Clayton Collins, I'm happy to announce that HousingWire's editor-in-chief, Sarah Wheeler, will be taking over as host. Wheeler has been with the HousingWire team since 2013 and boasts an extensive amount of real estate, lending, and fintech knowledge that we cannot wait to leverage this season. In the first episode of Season 4, Wheeler is joined by Odette Akushi, the Deputy Chief Economist at First American Financial Corporation. In this interview, the duo discuss Cushy's 2020 economic outlook, as well as her forecasting approach for the COVID-19 pandemic. Notably, the pair also discuss how low mortgage rates, high unemployment, and forbearance requests will impact the housing industry in 2021. But before we listen, here's a brief word from our sponsor.
Now more than ever, homeowners and borrowers of the future need to understand impacts and options during times of financial hardship. Freddie Mac has made home possible for 50 years and is committed to providing assistance and clarity to the housing market. Through All for Home SM efforts, Freddie Mac Single Family is leading the future of housing through insights, education, mortgage, and business solutions. Learn more about resources to help you and the clients you serve at sf.freddiemac.com/affordable-lending.
Thank you for listening, and here's the season premiere of the Housing News Podcast.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Sarah Wheeler, Editor-in-Chief at HousingWire, to kick off our fourth season of the Housing News Podcast. We've had such great industry response to this medium, and it is one of our favorite new ways to deliver incredible content. I'll be doing the interviews for this season, although Clayton Collins, our CEO, may be dropping in from time to time. I'm so excited to start off this season with Odette Akushi, the Deputy Chief Economist at First American Financial. Odette, great to talk to you today, and welcome to Housing News.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here today.
You know, this has got to be a really exciting time to be an economist. There's so much happening every day as the government and our industry work through this pandemic period. We have a lot to talk about, but first, I really wanted to get to know a little bit more about you. That's kind of what we try to do with this podcast, is talk first about the leaders themselves and then get into some of those weighty topics. So let's start there. So tell me about that. What got you interested in economics, and when did you know that this was what you would do for your career?
You know, I knew, I decided on economics in college, and the reason I did so is because I loved math. I love statistics, but I also love, you know, history and political science. And I realized that economics was kind of an intersection of all of those things. I could apply math, I could apply statistics to try and solve real world issues. And so I really honed in on economics in undergraduate, and then obviously continued on to grad school. And there's been no regrets about that decision. I found that it's exactly what I anticipated. You can apply policy and math and statistics to study just about anything.
Oh, that's so exciting. Yeah. It's just one of those things for many of the jobs in mortgage, you know, when you're a little kid, you don't know anything about. So it's not like, oh, I want to be this when I grow up. So it's so fun to find out how people got into this, you know?
Absolutely.
So you joined First American in 2015. So what drew you specifically to this field or to First American?
So I love housing. I'll just get that out of the way right now. I've always loved housing. I've been fascinated in it, you know, food, water, shelter, those are the basic human needs. And so I decided to go into shelter and understand kind of the drivers of demand and supply in the housing industry. And in 2015, there was a lot of talk about millennials. And, you know, there were the avocado toast forever renter generation. And I wanted to study demographics and what it meant for housing. And that was a really good time to do so as the millennials were starting to age into kind of the home buying age, or at least the oldest millennials. And so it was a really interesting time to get into housing, to start to understand the dynamics really driving demand. And then at the same time, the limitations of housing, which were really in supply, and the fact that there weren't a lot of homes available for sale. And here we are in 2020, those dynamics persist. In fact, you could argue they've intensified, right? Demand has continued to grow, as we've seen, and supply remains quite limited. And so, you know, that's a long way to say that I think the demographic story was really what interested me in 2015 when I first entered, and I've been studying that since.
Oh, it's so fascinating, especially because, I mean, to your point, those things continue. And also the effect of the millennial generation on housing, we are just at the beginning of that. It's going to be epic, as we all know.
Yeah, it's a massive generation.
They're just taking over. Well, let me ask you this. What's the thing that continues to fascinate you about your job on a daily basis?
So obviously I study the supply and demand dynamics, but what's really interesting to me and has really been piquing my interest more and more so is just the evolution within the housing industry, the change, the technological innovation, the financial innovation that's been impacting every piece of the mortgage process. And I think the fact that that continues to grow and continues to change on kind of a daily basis is really what keeps me so interested in this field. I just think it's an industry ripe for change, and we're kind of right in the middle of that.
I totally get that and totally understand. Love it. You know, so let's dive into the wildest year that any of us have been through, 2020. There's so much to talk about here. It's going to be one of those things that we all tell, you know, you tell your kids about. As an economist, how do you approach modeling or forecasting for something that we haven't experienced in the modern era, like a pandemic?
You know, you saw spreads in forecasts really widen, and that's really because none of us knew what to expect. We didn't know what a health-driven crisis would do to this economy. We didn't know, you know, the policy changes that would impact the course of the economy. And so what we decided to do is, first and foremost, use the most high-frequency data that we could get our hands on to really get a better idea of what's happening in real time. And that was really key in our forecasting methodology. And then I think second to that was building in scenarios. We would have a very pessimistic scenario, an optimistic scenario, and kind of a baseline scenario. A lot of that was based on kind of consensus forecasts. We did a lot of reading on what would likely be impacted. We read a lot about the path of kind of what people thought about the path of the virus. And so we'd build in different scenarios. And now as things start to get a little bit clearer, I think forecasting will also become slightly easier, but certainly it was very difficult in the beginning. And that's, you know, high frequency data and having different scenarios was kind of our tactic.
So walk us through some of the early months of the shutdown, especially, you know, March and April, that time frame. What indicators were you looking at to really see how bad this could get? Like, how did you know, you know, in your worst case, best case, whatever, you know, what were some of the things you were looking at?
So because we're so focused on housing, we were really looking at what would impact the housing market, and that is obviously the labor market. And so we were looking at high frequency data like initial jobless claims. Just to see, you know, how bad is this thing actually, how bad is the shelter in place and the shutdowns really going to impact the labor market? We were looking at that. We were looking at mortgage applications to see how demand is being impacted in real time. And then, of course, we were looking at the monthly indicators like building. You know, how are builders responding to this? How did they foresee demand in the months to come, and how are they responding? And so we really were trying to get a hold of the most high frequency indicators that we could. And to be honest, sometimes that was Google Trends. Sometimes we were looking on Google Trends to see how many people were searching for the key term, you know, filing for unemployment, and using that as potentially an indicator of what's to come.
You know, it makes total sense. That is how, you know, a leading indicator, I mean, way before we see anything else, you're going to see it come up there. So that makes total
sense. Absolutely.
You know, when the FHFA first started, first announced forbearance, there was a lot of questions about that. And there was a lot of uncertainty about how high those numbers would go, how many people were going to end up being in forbearance. And we just didn't know. So are you surprised by where they are now? I mean, they continue to go down. They're lower than they were last month. I mean, is that something that surprises you?
So I wouldn't say surprise necessarily. I think there was a lot of talk in the beginning that, you know, forbearance could hit 30%, and instead we peaked at 8.6. So obviously that was good news. We did anticipate some distress because of the labor market, because the unemployment rate was so high and continues to be stubbornly high. Obviously, it's very good news that we're starting to see, forbearance numbers slowly shrink. But of course, with unemployment remaining so high, we just saw initial claims today come out still above a million. And so I think we're remaining cautiously optimistic about what that means, because forbearance will be heavily dependent on the path of the labor market, and the path of the labor market will be heavily dependent on the path of this virus. So it's good to see those numbers come down, but we're not out of the woods yet.
Yeah, so let's talk about those labor numbers, because that was my next question. It was like, you know, when you think about the number of Americans who are still unemployed, so this is after some things have come back a little bit, depending on where you live. Right. How do you even begin to consider the impact of those unemployed people, not just, you know, in this year and next year, but 5 years from now? Like, how far does it set them back, especially when it comes to housing? Like, how do you really measure that impact?
Yeah, so, you know, to your point, a rise in unemployment has a negative multiplier effect on all portions of the economy. Most of economic growth is driven by consumer spending, and obviously you're not going to be spending if you don't have a job. So there's implications for economic growth for the years to come. And what we're really watching is permanent job layoffs, because the more permanent job layoffs we have, that's a trend that could slow recovery in the future. And speaking to the housing market in particular, this economic downturn has so far disproportionately hit renters. And you can kind of see that because home buying demand just continues to increase. So it so far has hit younger, lower paid workers in the services industry. But certainly if the labor market decline persists for some time, it will have an effect in other industries as well. And, you know, if you don't have a job, you can't save for a down payment. So it could certainly set back a potential home buyer for some years while they make up, you know, the money that they could have saved during that time.
That's really what I was thinking about. When you consider that home prices are increasing and rents are increasing before all this happened, right? And then you go, okay, if you've been saving for years for a down payment, especially in some areas of the country where it's so expensive, how do you ever get ahead of that curve? And especially now if you've lost your job for some time, right? And now you have to rely on your savings or, you know.
Yeah, this is definitely harder for potential first-time home buyers because, to your point, you know, a lot of them have been saving, and if they're out of work, that is absolutely going to slow down the amount of time it takes for them to make that down payment. I think the positive here has been the fact that rates have gone so low, and that's really been helping to push purchasing power. You know, with rates below 3% at this point, for those that can qualify for those rates, that's really been the positive in the housing market and really been pushing demand because of that boost in house buying power. But of course, you need an income, you need a job to qualify for a mortgage. And so, that's really the key here.
You know, you mentioned earlier housing inventory and how that, you know, even what was interesting to you about housing when you got into this and the fact that we're still seeing such an inventory shortage. How does that play into what you see for the next couple of years?
That's a great question, because really it comes down to the fundamentals. It comes down to what we all took in our Micro 101 class, which is just supply and demand. Now, I think all of us are more or less on the same page that demand is growing. You have a generational group, the bulk of which is turning 30 this year, which means they're going to continue to age into their prime home buying years. And so we anticipate household formation and demand to keep growing. Supply has been extremely limited and not able to keep pace with demand. And what that means is rising house price appreciation, just rising demand against limited supply is just econ 101 for rising prices. And that's exactly what we've been seeing. And we don't anticipate that dynamic to go away unless we can make supply increase and keep pace with demand. Existing homeowners are staying in their homes longer than ever. We see that in the tenure length data. And so there's a lot of pressure on builders to build new inventory to start to make up some of this gap.
Oh, for sure. And then, you know, we have to, as an industry, figure out how we can get some of the existing home stock that is not able to, you know, it's just not livable. What do we do with that? That's part of the solution, I think, but it's,
absolutely,
it's a thorny problem to try to figure out. We've seen different aspects of the pandemic affecting people who are Hispanic, people who are Black, more than other home buyers or potential home buyers. Have you seen that reflected in the things you're looking at and the indicators you're looking at? Or are those things broken out in such a way that you can really see that?
So we see that definitely in the monthly jobs report data, where we can look at who is being disproportionately impacted by this recession, which is particularly a services-driven recession hitting leisure, hospitality, transportation the most. And we do see, you know, younger workers hit the most, Black and Hispanic workers impacted disproportionately as well, lower wage workers impacted disproportionately. So that's really where we're seeing a lot of this play out in that data.
Hispanic homeowners have been, you know, a growing demographic and you know, expected to be the growing demographic going forward in the next, you know, 15 years. Do you think that this is a huge hindrance to that?
It goes back to the labor market impact. Certainly if the temporary job losses for this cohort turn into permanent job losses, that will absolutely slow down the amount of time that it takes them to afford that down payment. What we've seen in our research, and this is certainly backwards looking, is the longer run trend here is higher educational attainment, more income, which makes you more likely to become a homeowner. So the trend was positive leading into this pandemic-induced recession, but of course the recession is certainly going to set a significant portion of people back.
Yes, that's unfortunate. You know, overall, when we look at this pandemic, housing has been the bright spot for the economy, really one of the only bright spots in this period. Do you think it will continue as we go forward?
We do anticipate housing to lead this economic recovery. We're already really seeing housing as one of the only major sectors to experience a V-shaped recovery. And we do anticipate that to continue for at least for the remainder of the year. My crystal ball gets a lot hazier beyond that. But with rates expected to remain low for the foreseeable future, that should continue to prop up demand. But of course, so much of this is reliant on the labor market. So much of your purchasing power is reliant on your ability to have an income stream. And so that's really what we'll be watching, that along with consumer confidence. Obviously, you need to be confident to make the largest financial decision probably in your whole life. And so that's a metric that we're watching closely as well.
Okay, well, you know, in this downturn that we're in this recession that we're in, there's been so much, you know, angst about how housing was going to perform. How is this recession different than the last time?
So one of the things that we've studied is looking at foreclosure as a two-step process, what we call the dual trigger hypothesis. So first, the homeowner suffers an adverse economic shock, like a loss of income. But that doesn't mean that every delinquency has to turn into a foreclosure, because with enough equity, a homeowner has the option of selling the home or tapping into their equity through a refinance. And obviously, the reverse is also true. If the homeowner has little equity in their home but suffers no financial setback, a foreclosure will not occur. So this is what we're calling the dual trigger hypothesis. Now, today, Americans have record levels of home equity. The ratio of total mortgage debt outstanding to the value of the U.S. housing stock is at a record low 36%. Now, compare that with 54% on the eve of the Great Recession. This is a pretty large equity buffer that we have today that we did not have then. There's a couple other reasons. I won't get into too much depth into those, but comparing today versus then, homes are more rationally priced. The homes aren't overvalued now, whereas from the period from 2005 through 2007, the median sale price of a home was much greater than house buying power, which indicated an overvaluation of housing. That is certainly not the case today. And then, of course, in today's housing market, we're severely underbuilt, whereas we were overbuilt. on the eve of the Great Recession. So just a couple of reasons why this time it's different.
Those are really significant though, because I mean, I do think it's just such a difference. And one of the things I think is that back then you had whole neighborhoods that were affected. And, you know, there's just not that geographic, it's not that the virus hasn't had a geographic concentration, but jobs lost necessarily. It's not the same as like, oh, all of these jobs went away or whatever. And so you have whole neighborhoods where you have foreclosed homes. And it's, to me, that's one of the biggest differences between now and then, is that even if they had to go in forbearance, which I think there are, you know, much, much less and many more options, to your point, they could, many places they could sell, people would be happy to buy it, right? But also you're just not gonna have, you know, whole areas that are gonna be blighted.
Right, I think it's always important to go back to the fact that this crisis was not driven by a breakdown in economic fundamentals. Economic fundamentals were very healthy going into 2020. This is a health-driven crisis. And I think that is the main difference here, both in kind of in the general economy, but also specifically for housing. Lending standards were significantly different this time around. And of course, for the reasons that we mentioned, for housing this time, it's very different than it was on the eve of the Great Recession.
When do you feel like you're going to know we're out of the woods on this, as far as the pandemic, or as far as like when I see the indicators go here, when we see this happen, you know, obviously beyond just the like, this is what qualifies as a recession, but like what are things that you think here's where we're going to see some of those indicators early?
So I think back to the labor market, once we start to see people go back to work, I think that'll be an indicator of, you know, some more confidence in the economy, and also an indicator of reopenings. You know, once we start to see that number stabilize, I know there's a lot of news out there saying it's good that it's coming down. It is good that it's coming down, but it's still so incredibly high, you know, close, like nothing we've ever seen before. And so I think what I'll be watching closely is jobless claims, how many people feel they need the jobless claims to really live their life. And so it's the labor market indicators that I'll be watching.
What makes you optimistic when you look from here, say, to this time next year? Are there any things that you go, oh, okay, this is a good sign, this is optimistic?
I mean, moonlighting as an epidemiologist, as I said, so I'm trying to stay up on a lot of the kind of health news to see where we're at and what that might look like. But certainly being in the housing industry, I think I'm, you know, a little bit biased because I'm seeing all the positive data, all of the V-shaped recovery, the rebounds that are happening in the housing sector. And so I think that's where a lot of my optimism comes from, is just seeing this sector rebounding so quickly. But of course, that's not to say that people aren't suffering. Clearly, there's still a massive portion of the population that's suffering from this economic decline. But housing is, like you said, that it's the bright spot. And I happen to work in the housing sector.
Yeah, no, we have been, it's been kind of an odd experience to be reporting both on the really terrible things happening, but also the really great things. And we know this has been a banner summer for originators, whether it's refi or purchase. I mean, they've never been this busy. So, you know, it's a weird, you know, paradigm to be in, where it's like, we know people are hurting and we have family members, and I mean, it's not like we're unaffected by that, but at the same time, as an industry, I mean, it has been, you know, just a banner year.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is you can't forget about the fact that it's housing isn't just buying, it's also renting. And so always important to keep in mind that renters are feeling disproportionately burdened by this downturn, and they don't have an equity cushion. You know, so that's something that I keep in mind as well. I know that most of kind of my talk tracks and presentations revolve around home buying and what that means. But we always have to take ourselves back to housing is any shelter, buying or renting. And so renters are certainly feeling disproportionately hurt by this decline.
You know, when you look forward and you think about, you know, here's this event that we, you know, obviously there were some indications that this kind of thing could happen, but it's not like we thought, oh, 2020 is going to be the year that this happens. How does that affect you as an economist going forward? Does it make it, or, you know, how does it affect you personally or as a whole industry profession, thinking, you know, what is it that, does it make you look over your shoulder like, what else am I not thinking about? Or how do I think about another pandemic threat coming through?
Right. So this is going to be a huge learning experience, I think, for all fields, specifically economics. We'll be able to look back and see what the impact was on a lot of the Federal Reserve stimulus, a lot of which was unprecedented. What does that mean? Can we use these tools going forward? You know, what does fiscal response look like? Should it have been faster? Should it have been more? Should it have been less? We'll be able to really play out these scenarios. And use the data and use everything that we're going through right now as a tool for a kind of a future economic decline that's maybe health driven again. And I think that will be really helpful. But right now we're still in the thick of things and we're kind of learning as we go.
For sure. I know it'll be a great day when we can look back on it instead of saying, you know, constantly during the pandemic, we're still in it. It's still ongoing, but it'll be a great day when we can look back on it.
Yes, I think all of the data, all of the things that we're learning, all of the, you know, the adjustments on the forecasts and on our modeling, that'll be really helpful looking back.
Agreed. Well, Odetta, I so appreciate you coming on today. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with us, and it was great to have you.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Housing News Podcast. Please don't forget to give us feedback and rate us on iTunes. Also, make sure to check out HousingWire's latest podcast, The Daily Download, which is a daily wrap of HousingWire's hottest stories, now available on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. See you next week.